The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
In June of 1987, a big break on a year-old cold case landed in the lap of El Paso police. The case wasn't theirs. In fact, it wasn't even on their radar. Instead, it belonged to a jurisdiction almost 800 miles away, the Galveston County Sheriff's Department. A young Texas City woman, 19-year-old Shelley Sykes, was abducted there. Her car forced off the road by two men in a pickup truck, one of which violently shattered Shelley's window to get her, dragged her by the hair to the men's vehicle, and she was never seen again. These are some of the details the El Paso police read in a would-be final note they discovered as they investigated the attempted suicide of a man who was new to the desert city, John Robert King. They were shocked, of course, and alerted authorities in Galveston County, who had been chomping at the bit to solve the case of Shelley Sykes' disappearance. They were thrilled with the lead, too, as the young woman's disappearance had left the community in Texas City in a state of constant fear and paranoia as they wondered when Shelley's abductor would strike again. When King laid out his story, he told the police of an accomplice, Gerald Peter Zwarst, who also ultimately confessed to his role in Shelley's abduction, although the two men pointed the finger at one another for the responsibility of Shelley's demise. Zwarst and King were eventually charged and convicted for Shelley's abduction, but no evidence could be obtained as to what fate the 19-year-old met, because her body was never located. Upon the investigation into King and Zwarst, Galveston and the surrounding towns in Galveston and Houston counties were relentlessly scanning their unsolved caseloads to see if the two men could possibly be connected to other abductions, sexual assaults, or homicides in the area. In doing so, an interesting detail caught the attention of police in the small town of Seabrook, about 17 miles up the bay from where Shelley Sykes was abducted. Detectives there discovered that one of the men, Gerald Zwarst, had been arrested at a bar called Jason's Brown Saloon in Webster in 1983 for public intoxication, the same bar where a young woman was last seen alive that year, in fact, just 6 weeks prior to his arrest. Seabrook, Texas, is a resort town located in Galveston Bay in Harris County. It's almost cartoonish in its prototypically classic Texas Bay Town appearance. Like others similar to it, businesses and houses are painted vibrant colors, particularly in the waterfront district and the area surrounding it. Seabrook only considers itself a little less than 60 years old officially, as it was incorporated the same year that NASA's Johnson Space Center opened just down the road, 1961. But the land on which it sits has a history much older. This area, and much more, was originally purchased from the Mexican government in 1832 by a Virginian for agricultural purposes. And in 1895, Seabrook W. Seidner of Houston bought the town that soon became his namesake. He developed it as a resort where visitors rode a commuter train called the Suburban that ran twice a day in the summer, transporting leisure seekers from the hustle and bustle of Houston. From there, slowly but surely and in very low numbers, folks began coming to Seabrook to stay. Schools were built and a post office. Fishermen and merchants trickled in, as did gas and petrochemical executives and workers, as they sought permanent respite from the big city. Seabrook's population has always been modest, to say the least, and growth was at a slow crawl for much of the Baytown's first official 30 years or so. However, the small city's proximity to Houston, just 35 miles northwest, makes growth inevitable today, as Texas's largest city's insatiable and never-ending expansion continues to swallow up virtually every community that surrounds it. In 1983, Seabrook's population was somewhere around 5,000. It was small and peaceful, not the worst place in the world to live. Born in Mississippi, Susan Lee Eads came to Seabrook in 1978 with her family, which included her mother and four siblings. The Eads had lived in Charlotte, North Carolina for some time prior to their move to Texas, and at only 41 years old, her father died of natural causes in 1972. Susan entered Clear Lake High in Houston as a sophomore, the school that, at the time, all Seabrook adolescents in grades 9 to 12 were bused to. She graduated in 1981. Everyone loved Susan. She was fun, vivacious, and free-spirited. And Susan was tough, too. She was a spitfire, as her brother Dennis described her. She'd fight a tiger, he told KHOU Houston, and I would bet on her to win. Susan aspired to be famous and sought a career in modeling. By the time she was 20, in 1983, both her sister, Deborah, and her brother, Dennis, worked at NASA in Webster, just a few miles west of Seabrook. And Susan worked in Webster, too, not too far from the Space Center, at Charlie's Bar on Nassau Bay, and also waited tables at the Prickly Pear, a bar in the Holiday Inn in Seabrook. She also worked as a disc jockey whenever she could get a gig. Susan was still living at home and sharing a room with Deborah. On Monday, August 29th, 1983, Susan Eads spent the evening hanging out with friends and stayed the night at a friend's, heading straight to work the following day. Susan worked bartending the late shift at the Prickly Pear that night, Tuesday, August 30th. Though she was let off a little early. Susan headed to another bar across the street, Jason's Brown Saloon, to take a load off and have a few drinks. She left the bar at about 1 a.m., now the early morning of Wednesday, August 31st, 1983, and it was the last time Susan would be seen alive. Later that morning, among the brush in a ditch on an empty lot at NASA Road 1 and Elm Street in Seabrook, the nude body of Susan Lee Eads was discovered. Susan had been badly beaten, sexually assaulted, and strangled. As Seabrook police began investigating her murder, retracing her steps the previous night, they discovered that a man propositioned her at Jason's Brown Saloon. Susan refused the man's advances, which consisted of a drink and a dance. He was white with dark hair, about 25 to 30 years old, and customers who were at the bar that night were able to provide detectives with enough details of him to work up a composite sketch. In the sketch, the man is adorned with a cowboy hat and wears a handlebar mustache, details that, according to police, didn't make the person of interest stand out necessarily, since the mustache was fashionable at the time, and every other man in Texas wore a cowboy hat. No one knew who the man was, according to Jason's regular clientele, And though the patrons said that the interaction between Susan and this man wasn't the friendliest they'd ever seen, there wasn't necessarily any drama either. Witnesses at Jason's also observed the man leave behind Susan, following her to her car. Evidence on the scene where Susan's body was found was scant. Her purse was missing, and according to earlier reports, she was known to have been wearing her Clear Lake High class ring and a gold necklace, which were not on Susan's body when she was discovered, nor were they in her 1976 Chevrolet Monte Carlo, which was found in the parking lot of the Gulf State Yachts boat store close to the scene. Her car was in disarray, and though investigators weren't certain if the untidy car was a result of Susan's sloppiness or if a struggle had occurred, it has been theorized that something occurred inside the vehicle and led outside, as it's been reported that her clothes were found inside the Monte Carlo, one shoe inside and one shoe outside the vehicle. After exhausting the inquiry of friends, family, co-workers, and patrons from Jason's saloon, detectives questioned migrant workers who were in Seabrook and the surrounding areas performing repairs to downed power lines and damaged homes and businesses that had sustained damage as a result of the hurricane that had hit just days before Susan was killed. It was impossible, likely, to account for them all. Investigators could theorize all day, but there simply weren't enough clues at the scene to develop anything substantial. The investigation into the sexual assault and murder of Susan Eads was all but immediately cold. And then came the phone calls. Not long after her body was discovered, Susan's mother began receiving dead calls. When the calls started, the caller wouldn't talk, but she informed police anyway, and upon doing so, they placed a recorder on her phone. Finally, the voice of a man emerged on the other end, giving his name as only Bill. Susan's mother engaged him, desperate for any clue as to the fate of her daughter and the identity of her killer.
You said you knew Susan. Well, I still can't believe that I never knew of you. I don't understand that.
The man said he lived in Houston off Telephone Road, though he didn't allude to his precise location if he indeed was on or near Telephone Road. Bill was about 27 miles away. He told Susan's mother he had pictures of Susan.
But you have some pictures of her, you told me. I'd like to see them.
Well, I'm not going to show them to you. Just you, I ain't going to show them to anyone else. Some people have secrets, you know, they like to keep themselves.
Well, she wasn't one of them, I'm here to tell you.
He continued to call, but always hung up before he could be traced, and he never followed through with plans to meet Susan's mom to show her the photographs he claimed to have.
Would you want me to meet you somewhere? Do you want to come to the house, or what?
No, I don't want to come to the house.
You don't?
My place or hotel or something like that.
The calls ended, presumably, sometime shortly after Bill's failure or unwillingness to share with Susan's mother what he claims to have had. Second thoughts, perhaps, or a hoax. I spoke with retired Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office homicide detective Danny Smith about the calls.
I don't think much of those, to be honest with you. For whatever reason, I mean, you know, people just kind of suck like that, and something like this happens, and then some other weirdo decides he's going to taunt the family further by calling them, and he's got nothing to do with the crime. I'm not saying that the caller isn't the killer, but I put it on a low percentage possibility. I don't know. It just doesn't do a ton for me. Of course, as an investigator, I would love to identify that caller and eliminate him, you know, if that's possible. But I could also see that you're probably going to end up spending a lot of time chasing something that's going to end up in a dead end there.
We've run into many cases that involved probable prank calls or letters. Unfortunately, as Danny said, there are often individuals who get something, a thrill or a laugh, from doing such things to the families of victims. Regardless, it's probably not careless to assume that there exist more calls that the Seabrook police haven't released, and it's anyone's guess as to what those calls contain. Either way, hoax or not, the lead had fizzled, and Susan's case had barely become tepid before going cold again, until John Robert King and Gerald Peter Zwarst's confessions to the abduction of Shelley Sykes came nearly 4 years later. It's obvious why Zwarst's confession, in particular, was interesting to detectives in Seabrook. The investigation into him alerted police to the fact he was a regular patron of Jason's Brown Saloon, the last place Susan Eads was seen alive, by anyone other than the monster who raped and strangled her, and that he'd been picked up there by officers just 6 weeks after Susan's slaying for public intoxication, which alludes to some sort of disturbance caused by the man. But that lead, too, wasn't to be. It's unknown precisely how and why Seabrook investigators ruled Zwarst out, but it isn't a stretch to think that it had something to do with the fact that he was a regular customer at Jason's, and the man who was seen leaving directly behind Susan, following her to her car, was unrecognizable to those who witnessed it, many of who were also regular patrons there. Susan's case didn't even have a chance to warm up. And then came the arrest of a serial killer in Houston for the murder of a young woman there. Anthony Allen Shore first came to the attention of the Houston police when he propositioned an undercover cop posing as a prostitute in 1996. The following year, 1997, it came to light that Shore had been molesting his two young daughters for years. When he was charged, he gladly accepted a plea deal that his attorney negotiated with the Houston District Attorney. Shore served no prison time, was given a $500 fine, and 8 years of probation. Though he'd require to register as a sexual offender, Shore's record would remain free and clear of that particular charge if he kept his nose clean for 8 years. Not the finest hour for Texas justice. Shore was even allowed to continue living in his house next to an elementary school, a beyond special circumstance for a sex offender. They're generally required to stay 100 yards or more from schools as a condition of their registry. The deal was shameful. Shore, luckily, was subject to a law that was in its infancy in Texas and the entire country at the time, mandatory DNA collection for certain types of felony offenders, a law that has since expanded to include far more offenses. In the year 2000, when Houston police dusted off the cold case file of Maria del Carmen Estrada, a 21-year-old woman who had been raped and strangled, her partially clad body dumped in the drive-thru of a Dairy Queen on April 6, 1992, still in evidence was Maria's fingernail clippings. They were sent for DNA analysis and, after several issues with the labs law enforcement were using, they obtained a male profile in 2003. The profile was run through the database and a match came back. Anthony Allen Shore. Shore, of course, was subsequently arrested. He confessed to sexually assaulting and choking 21-year-old Maria del Carmen Estrada to death along with the September 26, 1986 rape and strangulation murder of 14-year-old Laura Lee Tremblay, the October 19, 1993 binding and sexual assault of 14-year-old Selma Jansky, the August 8, 1994 rape and strangulation of 9-year-old Diana Ribelar, and the July 6, 1995 rape and strangulation of 16-year-old Dana Sanchez, whose body he alerted a Houston television news station by phone to the whereabouts of. Because he injured his finger while choking Lori Tremblay to death, Shore told police, he began using a tourniquet to tighten the ligature around the necks of his subsequent victims to prevent injury to himself. Shore was convicted only in the murder of Maria del Carmen Estrada due to the prosecutor's perceived lack of evidence in the cases of his other confessed victims. He was sentenced to die by lethal injection on November 14, 2004. Upon his arrest in 2003, authorities in Seabrook and the Texas Rangers became interested in Shore for the sexual assault and slaying of Susan Eads. Anthony Shore would become known as the Tourniquet Killer, but investigators noted that it wasn't until after he hurt himself as he carried out the strangulation of Lori Tremblay in 1986 that he began using the tourniquet. Susan Eads' strangulation in 1983, detectives determined, was performed with the bodysuit she'd been wearing. Several details led investigators to wonder if Shore killed Susan. He'd returned to Texas from California not long before she was slain. He worked for Southwestern Bell upon his return, and since Hurricane Alicia had devastated the area just days before Susan was found dead, there were many telephone line workers in the area. Workers who regulars at local bars wouldn't have recognized. Shore, too, resembled the composite sketch of the man seen leaving behind Susan at Jason's Brown Saloon the last night she was seen. Patrons of at least one establishment whose telephone lines Shore serviced, a bar called Ernie's in Houston, called Shore Telephone Tony. In the calls Susan's mother received, the caller told her he lived on Telephone Road. Not exactly a smoking gun, but the detail was chilling nonetheless. The way in which Susan's body was discarded, left at the spot where she was killed with no attempt to hide her, detectives felt, matched Shore's method of operations in the way he disposed of bodies. A male DNA profile had been obtained in Susan's case, though, and it showed that Anthony Allen Shore was not a match. He claimed just before he died that the four murders that he confessed to were the only ones he is responsible for. Upon ruling out Shore in January of 2018, just before he was executed, Seabrook police released portions of the phone calls made to Susan's mother to a Houston television station in hopes that someone who saw the report would recognize the voice of the caller. It's a long shot that the calls will ever amount to anything substantial.
Like I said, for whatever reason, it's just kind of a crazy thing that, you know, there's just so many people in this world that are just not right, you know, and I don't know. It's probably mostly irrelevant because I doubt that at this stage they'll ever identify that person. I know they released some of those recordings trying to see if anyone recognized the voice. 30 years later, you're going to have a hard time, you know, does anyone recognize this person's voice? That's a pretty tough call there. You know what I mean?
The calls were the only portion of Susan's case file that the Seabrook police would release to us via the Freedom of Information Act. Almost 36 years after Susan Eads was raped and savagely strangled, though, few new leads have been developed, and a DNA match has not been made. Retired Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office homicide detective Danny Smith believes based on what little information we were able to give him, that Susan Eade's homicide was at the hands of a serial killer. He walked us through his thoughts on why, and Danny even brought up the close proximity of Susan's murder to the Texas killing fields, an area off Interstate 45 where the bodies of many young women were found, beginning in the 70s and continuing through the 1990s, many of which remain unsolved, an area that is a few short miles across Clear Lake from Seabrook and the scene of Susan's murder.
So the question obviously is, was she dragged over there? Did she go over there on her own? You know, the report said their body was dumped there, which would imply that, maybe she was dumped there and then the car was driven a short distance apart. But we have no idea like what position the seat was in, if it was a position that she would have used. You know, I don't know how tall she was or whatever. But anyway, there's those types of factors that we just don't know, so it's hard to say. But here's my instinct on the very, very level that I know about this case. Number one, I would say that it's a serial killer, and there's a couple of reasons why. Her jewelry was taken. It was never recovered. I doubt that her jewelry was taken because it had some tremendous value, but more so I believe it was taken as a souvenir, which is real common, very common with serial killers. The other thing is that she was discarded in the nude, which that tends to eliminate like boyfriends or, you know, in her case, it wouldn't apply, but a spouse. They typically are less voyeuristic with the way they dispose of their victims, where a serial killer just really isn't going to care. In fact, some serial killers actually pose the victims. They want them to be found in crude and crass manner. So I would say that you're probably looking at a serial killer, and the thing that comes to mind when I read these articles, again, you know, I mean, I always have to say I have such a limited amount of knowledge of this case, but with that very limited amount of knowledge, I would say that you've got a couple things of interest. I think of Ted Bundy because that people were talking about that this wasn't the type of girl to be a victim. So my thought is that you have a person that was able to convince her to give him a ride somewhere, maybe just down the street, you know, or whatever. Or maybe there was some kind of romantic interlude that started at the bar and moved on that people haven't reported or that we aren't aware of. But in any case, it seems to me like she would have left voluntarily with that person. And I believe that that person may have had his vehicle parked elsewhere for that exact purpose, because it gets a little bit hard to justify this in my mind. But if you're only a few miles from the bar, why would she stop at a yacht store? I have to assume that that time of night, the yacht store is closed. So there would have to be a purpose to go there and to stop. Well, if he's not in the car with her, or if she didn't follow him over there to, you know, do whatever, doesn't seem to work in most scenarios. My sense of it is that it was probably more like a Ted Bundy, where this person was no threat to her whatsoever. Maybe even she found him appealing and she went with him or took him, drove him somewhere, you know, to either do a favor, or maybe they were going to, you know, drive over there and have some kind of a relationship or whatever. And that kind of explains the people that were saying, you know, that this isn't the kind of girl that this would happen to. I found it interesting that there's that corridor there that seems to be famous and, you know, for sexual assaults and sexual murders and serial killers. And, you know, so, I mean, that also bolsters my instinct that, you know, this is the type of case that I would say was a serial killer. You've got all the elements, you got the sexual assault and the nude body dump and the souvenir that's taken from the victim. So my sense of it is that's exactly what you're looking at, which of course means it's, you know, going to be one of your most difficult cases unless, you know, something pops with DNA. And unfortunately, when you're talking about these cases that are, you know, 25 years older, first and foremost, you have to hope that they're doing everything they can with the new technology. And primarily what I mean by that is DNA and the familial DNA. And that's how these older cases like those are going to get solved, quite frankly, especially when you're talking about a stranger murder. You're probably at least 80% that it was a stranger in this case. The reason why I say that is I think that, you know, yeah, someone said that someone was seen following her out of the bar to her car. Well, if it was someone that was known to her, it would be probably someone known to everybody, you know, in a small town at a bar. So, and that's to say if that person is the killer. But then if he's the killer, that also kind of comes full circle to what I was saying about that he was no threat to her, because otherwise the person that saw him walking out there would have also perceived a threat. You know what I mean? Just the whole Ted Bundy thing pops into my head, just kind of a, you know, hey, can you give me a ride? You know, I walked, you know, a couple miles down the road, have a flat tire, walked up here to use the phone, whatever. You know, 83, no one had cell phones. So there could be a number of reasons that, you know, you could talk a person into giving you a ride down the road if you're not a creepy, you know, obviously a serial killer type of person, but more of a, you know, well-presented type. The 80s were a different time than now. I mean, people still picked up hitchhikers fairly regularly. I mean, they were being warned not to, but it was, you know, it wasn't as bad as the 60s, but it still was a regular thing.
The Galveston Daily News, the Houston Chronicle, the New York Times, KHOU 11 Houston, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Thanks for listening, y'all.
My name is Hunter.
And I'm Haley, and we're your hosts of
Murder and Such, a podcast about true crime, serial killers, and other dark subject matter. Join us while we fill your ear holes with some crappy comedy and disgusting tales.
You can now find us on Spotify,
iTunes,
Stitcher,
Podbean,
and all of your podcatcher services. You can like us on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter
@MurderAndSuch.
Hope to hear from you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye.